RSTC must not be the future.
You know it is.
I feel like we had that talk recently. Anyway, what's up?
What is up?
I don't know. I don't think I've legitimately talked to you in like 2 weeks almost. It feels like that.
Well, yeah, you've been busy with that married life, which is so totally different from, you know, the week before when you were not married.
Yeah.
How'd things go?
They're fine.
No, I meant with the thing. You did a little thing?
Yeah, it was fine.
It was fine. Good. You got a little honeymoon planned later this year. Good talk.
We will. Sorry. I'm distracted. Thing. Thomas says that he can't see the stream at all. Maybe the whole internet thing is falling apart.
It's overrated anyways. You know, we had a good run with this whole internet thing. I don't think society's really ready for it yet. Just let it crash and we'll start over again. Maybe with better email support next time.
So who knows what's going on?
Well, Thomas is on a PC, so could be anything. Literally anything. Just reboot it, Thomas. That fixes all of Windows problems. Anyway, I don't know if you listened to the show last week, but again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Man, I'm so happy for you and Jamie. And I don't know what else to say other than that's great for you guys. You folks. Can't say guys.
People. Gender neutral terms.
People.
Yes.
I think I like folks. Folks is a good plural use. I could do y'all. Yins apparently is the Pittsburgh. People say yins.
Ewins.
Is a thing. Ewins.
Mm-hmm. So what's been going on that side of the country?
We actually do have a topic tonight. We need to boot around the bush with this nonsense. Sean, I got a new keyboard. you spent like a whole episode talking about how awesome this Moonlander Mark I keyboard is. Finally decided to business expense treat myself. It's a tax write-off, Sean. It's basically free. You just write it off. The government pays for it, right? That's how tax write-offs work.
Somebody pays for it, yeah. That's like the Schitt's Creek thing where he's like, what is it? He got the credit card, right?
Yeah. Just write it off. Then you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So I got the Moonlander Mark I. It's white. I got box white keys. I think it's pronounced Kale or Kali. No idea. Box white keys.
I think Kali is what I've heard people say.
Kali.
Yeah.
Like Calico Cat.
Because it's K-A-H-L-I, right?
K-A-I-L-H.
K-A-I-L-H. Kali? That doesn't sound... Anyway, continue on.
Yeah, so... Boy, initial thoughts. I'm already used to using split keyboards. I've been using the Microsoft Sculpt forever, which is really nice because it's just a great keyboard. It's, you know, it's not mechanical, but it does have the nice split design. And it has this great thing where it actually tilts away from you. So like most old school keyboards have like the feet in the back, so it tilts up towards you. So it's kind of like stadium seating where the space bar is lower than the function row at the top, right? Which is just terrible for your wrists if your keyboard tray is at the proper height, because you're tilting your wrist back, and that's just a non-starter. So I've always used my keyboards flat for years. The Microsoft Sculpt tilts away from you, which is a great feature. And so anyway, I was used to that, and I wanted to try something new and different because I've been hacking away on my work computer on the freaking butterfly key switches on the MacBook Pro, which is, that's just not going to stand. So I was already used to doing split typing, the orthographic key layout where the keys are, instead of being staggered, they're in columns.
Oh, ortholinear?
Ortholinear. That kind of tripped me up for like a day or two, but I'm used to that now. And actually I'm very, very fast typing prose on this thing. For most like written text, I've been using the little tester functionality on their website where you can, you know, try different types of code practice and see your progress over time. And I can type at basically normal speeds for prose. For code, I'm about like 29 words per minute like 95% accuracy, not great. Mostly because there's just not enough keys. Like for coding, you use so many, you know, brackets and and you know, operators, and you're moving around a lot. So I'm still trying to figure that out because there's just not enough keys. I ended up having to put some of my programming keys on like other layers just so I could find them without having to like search all over the keyboard for them.
Yeah, I think it sounds like you had a pretty easy transition because mainly you were already used to the split key. I think when I switched to Ortho, I don't remember if we described it or not, but Ortho basically, instead of having keys scattered or staggered from left to right, they're just in a horizontal and vertical grid aligned with each other. Like an ice tray, I guess, right? A couple ice trays stacked on top of each other. I was not used to split keyboard. So like, for example, I realized that I hit the B key on my with my right hand a lot, whereas on the split keyboard here, the B key is on the left side. And like T and Y, sometimes I'd mix them up, things like that. So I think I had a hard time with that. I don't think that I had a hard time with ortholinear. It was more so I had a really hard time with the meta keys. Because I think the default Moonlander layout has the meta keys. Actually, I don't recall even where they are. Are they like on the back left side? The bottom left side?
I don't know. It's really bad. I ripped that default config right out because it was not good.
So I had a hard time. Like, I tried putting the meta keys on the thumb clusters. That didn't work at all either. So yeah, I had a hard time figuring that out.
Yeah, it took me I spent probably half a day last weekend just fiddling around with it and trying to see what felt best. Where I landed on was most of the modifiers I kept sort of on like the outside of the keyboard where they normally live. So like escape key is where it is, control, shift, right? Those are all kind of where you expect them.
Mm-hmm.
Command key, I use that a lot, right? So I moved that to the thumb cluster right here. That's my closest left thumb. That's great. And then my right thumb is mostly spacebar and enter key. Backspace even I put way up here because like, I don't know, it's just what I was reaching for, man. Like I can only change so many things about my setup at once and still be productive. So
right.
I would love to put more common things on my thumbs, but I'm just don't have the muscle memory for that right now.
My thumbs are they used to be almost the same actually. Where I had space, delete and enter in that order. So space on top, delete in the middle, and enter on the bottom. And that worked out pretty well for me. So now on the right hand side, it turns out that I hit space bar with my right thumb a lot. So I took that space away and changed it to something else, but ended up moving it back because it was really annoying. So now on the right hand side, space is top. And then the second or the middle key actually switches to a layer while I'm holding it. And then the bottom key switches to another layer while I'm holding it only.
Yeah, I ended up doing it on the left side as well to get this code functionality where I hold my left thumb and then I get all my code symbols on a second layer.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
Anyway, the thing that worked the best for me was I didn't like the default layout. I searched around on the shared layouts and I found one that was called like beginner Mac OS programmer layout. I was like, yes, perfect. Not beginner programmer, but beginner keyboard user, right?
Yeah, sure.
And so I took that, I forked it or whatever, and made it my own. And that was a good starting point for me. So I the sharing feature was super, super helpful. I love all the web utilities and the way that all works.
So that's what keeps me, I think, will keep me rather with these Ergo, I can't remember what the company's name is, right? But Easy, they make the Plank.
ZSA?
Yeah, ZSA, that's right. Because they make the Ergo Docs, they make the Moonlander and the Plank keyboard. I actually have the Plank over here.
Oh yeah, you just got the Plank. It's so tiny.
Yeah, 40%. For anyone that can't see it, I'll put a link in the show notes. But yeah, it's ortholinear 40% keyboard.
That's impossible to me.
I thought so too. So this is not the first 40% keyboard I've owned. And again, this kind of like goes into my point of like the software, the QMK, I think is called, the software that runs on these. I think that's really what makes these so accessible to me because I can really make it work however I want to. Yeah, like I've never seen a space bar that small. So the keys to the right and left of the space bar are called raise and lower, and they only change the layer while your thumb is pushing down. So for example, on the left side, if I push down the lower key, I guess for people that don't know what a 40% keyboard is not a normal keyboard. The first row at the very top of the keyboard is usually like a function row or a media key. Then you usually have like a number row behind that or below that. And then you have your letters, right? So 40% keyboard, there is no function row or numbers. You have to use letters to get around. So on the left-hand side of the space bar, your thumb switches it to lower. And when it's in the lower mode, the top row goes to symbols as if you're holding down shift one, shift two, shift three. On the right-hand side, if you hold it down, the top row turns to numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had other 40% keyboards before where the layers were like at different places. And it wasn't like, I don't know, this setup where it's like on either side of the space bar works really well. So it took me maybe, I would say honestly, 15 minutes of just typing with it to feel pretty comfortable. And then of course, like you have to like the lower key, I don't know if you can see it on the camera, but see how like the ones at the top here change colors to red.
They change colors. Yeah.
Yeah. So those ones are like open paren, close paren, open bracket, close bracket. And then if you use the raise on the right hand space bar, the same keys go to, you know, like braces and stuff. So, yeah, I think what really is going to keep me, like what won me over with these ZSA keyboards is how malleable they are. And that, you know, the QMK, firmware that they're running on, but also the web interface, the configurator, you plug your keyboard in, go to the configurator site. I believe it's a Rails app. Like I was kind of digging around the source code a little bit, or, you know, the rendered source code anyway. And just like the sheer number of features is unreal. Like auto shift, I don't really use that anymore. The tap dance feature, literally any key can be anything. So on my Moonlander, on the right hand side, on the very bottom row, I have arrow keys in the layout of Vim. So like H would be left, J would be down, K would be up, and L would be right. So it's those shapes on the very bottom. But they're red on my keyboard. For me, red means macro. And so my arrow keys actually switch spaces in Mac OS. So I have a whole thing. I have a whole system here for arrow keys. But the fact that like it can just be whatever I want is super, super nice.
Yeah, the thing about that is it's so open-ended. When I first got this, I'm like, man, how am I going to, I'm never going to use that. You know, like I'm never going to use this to its full potential. Yeah, I can do all this cool stuff, but I just want it to work and be basic. But as soon as you start to think, oh, just one more thing. Oh, this wouldn't this be cool? And you start to accumulate these little, they almost feel like little hacks.
Yeah.
You know, you just little bits of functionality that are suited to your style and how you do things. I color coded everything, right? So I have a color code for keys that type things on the screen. I have a color code for modifier keys. Like those are yellow. All my letters and digits are purple. All my modifiers are, anything with white space or moving around is green. And blue is my like macro / keyboard keys, right? And anything that could delete, like escape and backspace, those are red. Danger, red, right?
Oh, that's cool. I only have like three colors besides white.
That's the only way I keep track of it, because when you shift layers, suddenly your keys don't do what they is shown on the key. And like when you're a beginner to this, you have to look at the keys the whole time. And so if I'm on some weird mode and I look down at my hand, I'm like, this is not the K key. This is doing something totally different, right? So
yeah. So I can already see people like rolling their eyes, or like, how could it possibly, it doesn't seem like it could make you more productive, but it sounds like, I mean, like it was funny, like watching you first try to type on it. It's, you know, like it was like waiting for you to mail a letter, in Discord messages and stuff, but it sounds like you've gotten pretty comfortable with it. Could you see yourself going back to a sculpt and being sculpt keyboard and being happy with it?
So I am toggling between them for now, like one's on one PC and one's on the other. So I do just go between them. Going back to the sculpt, the only thing that really hangs me up is mostly the staggered versus the rows, you know. We'll try going back and forth, because I do use my laptop a lot too, and that's just a straight up keyboard, and that's not gonna change. So I'm gonna have to learn to be I don't know, what's the keyboard equivalent of bilingual? Bi layout?
Polykeyboarderous? I don't know. Yeah, see, like Thomas is saying, can't go back to a normal keyboard, because Thomas has the Ergo Docs, I believe, which is different from both of ours.
Yeah, so I want to go touch on that in a second, but just like mechanical keyboards. I got her one. She loves it. And I was like, come on, try this. This is so cool. And she sits down and she starts to type. She just said, this is torture. She's like, I type just like you said before. I use my right hand to cross over to my left hand when I'm typing. I'm like, oh my God. Like, this would just not work.
Yeah.
So, now the ErgoDocs. ErgoDocs is interesting. So when you're shopping for these things, it's not obvious the difference between the ErgoDocs and the ZSA, or excuse me, and the Moonlander, if you're shopping for this on the website, because they're basically the same price. They run the same software. They have the similar feature sets. And I didn't really know what to pick. You know, they say Moonlander is the next generation one. I know you have it. You love it. That's why I went for that option. I do kind of regret it. I kind of wish I got the ErgoDocs. The main reason I say that is because the ErgoDocs, while being less attractive than the Moonlander, the Moonlander is this beautiful sculpture that just sits on your desk. It's awesome, especially when it's all lit up. Whereas the ErgoDocs looks more like someone is using the ErgoDocs because they have like a RSI and have like a wrist brace on. It looks like a tool, right?
Right.
But the ErgoDocs is cool because all of the modifier keys on the outside, the left and the right side, are longer. They're 1.5U. They're the width of 1.5 keys. So tab, caps lock, shift, control, backspace, you know, where all those other things are. Those are wider on the ErgoDocs, and my fingers, my pinkies, are used to feeling for that and having that room to just grab for them. So just kind of orient myself. I really miss that. You know, having shift be a single key, I'm getting used to it, but not ideal. You know, I wish I had those bigger keys on the edge because I do use those modifiers a lot.
Yeah, I don't think I ever thought about the difference in widths of the keys.
And so I'm saying you don't realize that stuff until you actually try it. Like, you can't just visually look at it and come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
So that was just a kind of a PSA for that. And the other thing I think the ErgoDocs would be better for me is these thumb clusters. On the Moonlander, there are 4 keys on each thumb, and they're on this like pivoted thing that tilts away from you. I think maybe my hands aren't big enough, but it's hard to reach some of those further away thumb things. Whereas with the ErgoDocs, there's no hinge there, and they're also in the same plane as the main keys. So they don't tilt away, and they're closer to home row. So where your thumb lands on that closest thing, it's actually much, much closer to the main home row. And so it just requires a lot less movement. And I feel like I would use those thumb keys a lot more if they were closer and I didn't have to reach for them as much.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'd be interested to try an ErgoDocs for sure.
I don't regret this at all. I said regret, but I don't regret this at all. This is awesome. I would love to try the ErgoDocs. I think I would like it more.
Yeah, I would like to. I would like to try one as well. But I'm pretty happy with my setup. And I even like ported some of it over to my MacBook keyboard. The weather's been nicer, so I've been working from outside lately. And there's a couple of things that I really, really, really got used to and really like. And I ended up like looking for software to help me with this for macOS. So I mentioned I had like a whole system for arrow keys. And how this works is caps lock, I have mapped to hyper when I'm holding it. So hyper is all for the modifier keys, command, option, shift, and control at the same time. So you would use hyper for like remapping custom keyboard shortcuts, because most apps keyboard shortcuts don't use all 4 modifiers. So it's kind of like a, you know, there's less collision there when you're doing that. So caps lock, when I'm holding it is hyper. When I tap caps lock, it fires escape. So it's like a multi-use key. So I'm in Vim a lot. I use escape quite a bit. I also really like to close modals and dialogues and popovers with escape too. So I'm just kind of used to it. And one thing that was hard for me to get used to was I kind of showed how on my right hand, the arrow keys are down at the bottom. So I found it hard to use. It's not just straight down on the keyboard. It's kind of like down and right. Like a normal keyboard is like that anyway, but this isn't what I would expect to on a normal keyboard. So I had a hard time like shifting down because my left finger wants to be on the down arrow, not the left arrow, because again, home room and Vim stuff. So I just got rid of those keys altogether. Those are macros now. And so now when I'm holding down hyper and I hit H, J, K, and L, they just fire the regular arrow keys for me. So now I use the arrow keys from the home row all the time. And even on Mac OS, I do that too. So I use an app called Carabiner to remap, and I uploaded my config to a gist, which I can share. So if this sounds interesting to you, hyper plus escape on the caps lock key plus the Vim style movements, you could install Carabiner and use my config and kind of get a similar setup.
That's cool. Yeah, I didn't like any of the key features that relied on time. So tap dance, they call it, I think, right, where you can tap or long press or double tap or whatever. I can't do that. And the auto shift, where you press and hold the letter to do shift, I can't do that because it builds in latency. Like when you press a key, now the firmware in the keyboard has to wait and see, is he going to press it again? Is he going to long hold it? What's going to happen next? We don't know. We have to wait until some timeout before we can put that letter on the screen, right? So if I tap A or hold A, it has to know whether it's a tap or a hold or like a double tap. And that latency between me tapping and the thing showing up on the screen drove me insane. Like I could not make the timeout short enough to make it worth it. So all of those like features where you can use a single key for multiple functions, I just completely wrote off because the latency it felt like it was broken.
You probably just type faster than I do because it wasn't that big of an issue for me.
Yeah, I don't know. The fun things I mapped to some of my keys were Command Shift Space. That brings up the emoji picker. So some apps don't have emoji support, so I just hit that button and the emoji picker comes up and I can just throw stuff in there. And then one of the things I mapped to Command S because I save a lot. And I don't know. It's nicer hitting one button than two. And the last fun thing I did was map a button to the screenshot abomination of, key presses, Command Shift 4. So I've just got that on a single key, which is fun.
Yeah, I should probably do that with the layer. So I mentioned my mouse layer. I have a mouse layer and a space switching layer and stuff like that. So I should probably do some more things like that. But
the mouse layer, man.
I don't use it often, but I use it sometimes. More than anything, I could just slap like a page up and page down key on here, but I use the scroll wheel up and down functionality quite a bit for scrolling around. But this is the most comfortable iteration I've had of a keyboard and an interop between like a split ortholinear to my MacBook keyboard. It feels truly seamless now. I don't feel uncomfortable in either situation. And I've complained countless times about the stupid like rectangular shaped arrow keys where the up and down are half size, right? Now I don't care about that anymore because I just don't use them ever.
Awesome.
Oh, I hate those things.
Well, anyway, two thumbs up on the Moonlander and I assume also the ErgoDocs. These box white keys, again, my personal new favorite key switch. I'm only going to be getting keyboards with these switches on them from here on out. I've got a gaming keyboard over here behind me that has cherry reds and I hate them. And that's next on the list, man. I don't know if I can business expense a gaming keyboard, but Iris, don't call me.
Just get a little plank.
No.
Nice little plank keyboard over here.
No. Not happening.
It's just the QM cake firmware and the software that ZSA makes is it for me. They're so good. Cha-ching, right? They're not sponsoring the show, but.
So that's all. Thanks again for pushing this direction. I'm starting to, it took a few days. It was a little frustrating, especially when you're trying to like actually get work done. But I spent some time in between, I run the little training things. They have a little training thing where you can do some Ruby code, which is pretty cool. They've got some pros, they've got some dialogue, and Cory Doctorow, I assume, is always on there because his stuff's open source, so people always just use it as examples for things. It's fine. He created Boing Boing. Remember Boing Boing? That was a thing.
Like the airplane internet. Oh, that's Boingo. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh man, that was is it still a thing? Still a thing. Anthony confirms.
Anthony has confirmed it's still a thing.
Used to be a zine, indie zine back in the day. Transferred over to the blogosphere. And anyway, Cory Doctorow.
Speaking of zines, Thomas hit me with some zines yesterday. So I put in the Discord that I was kind of doing a little bit of a deep dive for myself on web fundamentals. So I've been making websites for a long time or web apps for a long time, but I've never really strolled through like the MDM docs to look at the web APIs available. And there are a lot of them, right? Quite a few. Actually, I should probably have this link ready. MDN web APIs. Also, a fun little thing is that if you type mdn.io/ and then just start typing a search term, it will forward your search term into DuckDuckGo and then click on the first result for you. So you can quickly get to MDM things there.
MDN is the Mozilla Developer Network.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with MSDN, Microsoft Developer Network.
That's right.
Yeah, before Mozilla Developer Network was a thing, whenever you typed a web API into Google, you would get freaking W3 schools.
Right.
Which is not a great source. I mean, a lot of people cut their teeth on that, but in modern days, not a great source. I go to MDN for anything browser related now. A lot of the W3 schools examples are out of date. Like, they've just never been touched since someone wrote them. And they're just not nearly as complete and thorough and consistent as the way the Mozilla developer docs. I mean, the MDN docs are laid out like docs, whereas W3 schools is more laid out like a series of small tutorials. Yeah, plus it looks ugly.
I put in the Discord that I was like looking to kind of do a deep dive if anyone had anything that was sort of essential to look at, and Thomas dropped a few links to some zines that kind of like, one of them covered headers. So I'll have to put those links in the show notes because they're kind of cool to see.
I think we might have different definitions for what a zine is.
A zine? Yeah. This is a zine. They're zines. So I've been looking into this project called Remix.run lately. I saw a couple of videos on YouTube, and it's created by Ryan Florence and Michael Jackson. And so those names are pretty big in the React world. So they created, at least I know Ryan did, I think maybe both of them did, but they created and maintained React Router, which is sort of like the biggest router out there. And I know that Michael Jackson works on Unpackage, which is a CDN. Unpackage serves over 70 billion requests per month without making a dent to the credit card bill, because they use they rely on HTTP caching and CDNs to make it work. So what leads me to the web fundamentals is that I caught a couple of videos. Shout out to Anthony for kind of talking about Remix a little bit. And so Remix is essentially a meta framework on top of React. So I've talked about like Blitz.js in the past. But basically, it's built on top of React, but it's a framework. So I guess Next would be another sort of meta framework where it gives you the framework things, but it's built on top of React. So one thing that's different about Remix is that their whole focus is on sort of the fundamentals of the web and server-side rendering first and things like that. So I'll drop a link to the video, but they did a beta preview recently, a stream, and they're going through building this application with Remix. And then halfway through, he's like, oh yeah. And he turns JavaScript back on. So the whole time he had JavaScript disabled, and the site was working as you would expect, because it's just a regular old website, you know, the fundamentals of building apps. So, I mean, he was building forms and doing all this stuff with JavaScript disabled, because it just renders a regular old web page instead of, you know, bringing in all these complicated libraries to kind of do this for us. And the whole idea behind Remix is that the web does a lot of, the web as a platform does a lot of stuff for us, a lot of complicated stuff for us, a lot of UX-based stuff for us that many times we kind of just throw away with the JavaScript tooling that we're using. And so the philosophy behind Remix is, why would you throw that away? So they're going back to the progressive enhancement ways of things, where make it work and then enhance it, enhance the experience from there. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. And so like digging into Remix a little bit, made me want to go back and see like what's so good about HTTP caching and what's so good about like the fetch API and what's so good about all these other things. So that's kind of like what set me down the rabbit hole in the first place.
It's really interesting to look at the web and RFCs and the way the web was designed and how, and even just looking at TCP and just like the basics of networking, application layer networking, and how sort of prescient those people had to be when they were designing it to make it so general purpose that it is valuable still today in this world where we have this immense churn in the technologies and the front end language and even the back end languages too. Like, all this stuff is built off of the same foundation that was designed to be malleable and designed to handle the common use cases in a standard way. And so it is cool to get back to that fundamentals. It is cool to get back to those fundamentals, and because those carry over to any framework that you're going to use, you know, everything you're doing is just another, means to that end, right? It's just another way of wrapping up all those web things into something else that, you know, and like, you know, looks pretty. But I just think it's really interesting and valuable. Absolutely.
So I guess more about how it's structured. Well, first of all, I want to shout out Anthony, because he dropped a link in the show notes or in the chat about a post that he wrote, like a first look at Remix. By the way, Anthony's been going off on dev.2, so I should just drop a link to his blog there. I don't know if you call it a blog, but his articles, he's been writing a ton of them.
It's a zine.
His zine. Yeah, Anthony's zine on dev.2. But yeah, so a little bit more about how Remix is kind of structured. It by meta framework, like, you have React, and I guess like if anyone's familiar with Next, you basically you can export these functions from your page components, right? So like get static props, get server side props. So you give it a name and you export it, and the framework will just do the thing with that, right? Similar to Nuxt with middleware and stuff. So Remix is similar. They have some different concepts like loaders and things like that, but you basically have a page component and you export different functions based on what you need, and it stitches it all together for you. And so what's cool about Remix is that since a lot of it, the focus is on sending HTML over the wire and then enhancing from there. A lot of the examples that I've seen are using things like Prisma, which is a JS ORM. They just use it directly in these loader functions because it's not shipping to the website. It's happening server side. So you kind of get like this seamless feel of like JSX as like a nice templating language. I mean, that was always one of my hangups in the past, is like, you know, I don't hate, like, Blade, for example, in PHP land is really good. And EEX is pretty okay, but I've never felt as comfortable with those server-side templating setups as I have with, say, like Vue or React JSX. So it feels like a really good mix of both worlds, where it's like, oh yeah, like, I'm really used to this templating. There's a lot of really good tooling for the templating and it makes sense. It's composable, but also I can just sort of interact with my data without having to worry about making API client all the time if I want to use these abstractions.
So what is it about this that makes it indifferent than a modern, you know, JS equivalent of a Rails or JS equivalent of a Laravel or something like that? Maybe I'm missing it.
There's not nearly, so it doesn't prescribe an ORM for you. It doesn't prescribe like a worker setup or a job running setup for you. It basically just wraps up the front end experience and it ties them together. So you could use whatever library you wanted to on the back end side of things, and it's going to do the stitching and data fetching for you.
Interesting. So it is SSR, server side rendered, mm-hmm. on the fly, I guess. It's not statically compiled.
Right.
It's still just rendering plain old HTML. But because you are writing it in JavaScript and running it on the server, but still have the ability to sort of hot upgrade it on the client if the client supports it. And that's all where the magic comes in, I guess.
Correct.
Is that true? Is that the best way of characterizing it?
Yeah, that's the best way. And then I guess what makes this different than, so like people would say, how is this different from Next, right? So Next focuses on you can do server-side rendering with it. You can do static building. I think they actually focus a lot on static building or incremental static building. So instead of building the entire property, you build pages when they're requested and store them in a CDN, or, you know, that's the incremental side of it. With Remix, the focus is on going back to fundamentals. So you can export a function called headers or something like that. And it's literally just setting the header. So on any page, you can set cache controls for the data. On any page, you can, you can do it from a page by like a page by page basis, but it's like super configurable in that way. And that way it's going from like relying on, you know, these static builds to saying like, why not? Like, if you know how the data is going to change or how often you need it to change, why not just set a cache header? It's already there. Browsers already use it. And it's nothing extra. So you don't have to pay for, you know, rebuilding a whole site. Or if you're doing incremental builds, you don't have to pay for doing the incremental builds. You have to pay for serving content. But if it's, you know, if you're utilizing the cache headers, then you're only paying when you're refreshing those. I mean, I'm sure there's more to it than that. I did a cursor grant. So the big hang up for a lot of people is that it's not free. It's not open source.
I was just going to mention that.
Yeah. So you buy a license. They have indie licenses and enterprise licenses or business team licenses. So in the last stream they did where they're kind of like showing it to everybody or showing the latest version of it to everybody, they mentioned that the goal is to get business licenses. And if they can make it sustainable, then they'll just make the indie licenses free, which is nice. But yeah, that's the big hang up. If you start Googling for this, that's the first thing you'll see is people just like, I'll never use this because I don't want to pay a penny for it, you know? And I can totally understand that. Like Next is free. Next is pretty killer, you know?
Sure. But here's the flip side of that coin. Like I kind of had that initial response too. Like, oh, I gotta buy a license. What? Mm-hmm. Like this is software, man. This is the web. Everything's open and free. But the more I think about it, that it does two things. First of all, it incentivizes businesses who want a stable platform. Like I'm paying for a thing. I'm going to, you know, that comes with support and quality ostensibly. And also number two, like, that just keeps the quality of it that much higher. You know, how many open source projects do you look at and have 1500 open issues on GitHub? Like what a quagmire that can be, right?
Mm-hmm.
In theory, if you're paying someone to do this thing, they're going to be incentivized to actually work on it, improve it.
Right.
Especially if it's so, you know, relatively narrow in scope, they can stay on top of that. So I think it's actually a plus. You know, good for them for trying, especially, you know, the idea where you're basically bootstrapping with commercial enterprise and then making it available.
Yeah. So another argument for it when they're talking about it is you're essentially adding Michael and Ryan to your team at that point, because you're a paid customer, you have direct access to them and support. So, especially in a business license, you have these two people that have been huge. One might even say like prolific in the React community. And now you have access to them and direct access to what they're making. So, yeah, it's really interesting. So, I mean, transparently, I bought it, and you know, I may use it, I may not use it, but for me, it was interesting. I wanted to support, I suppose. And I'm in a position that I'm able to do that. So I wanted to do that. Going back to like the web fundamentals and like the APIs available to us, what's really interesting is that instead of have all these other abstractions that they've kind of invented on around like forms and around like form data and request and response objects, they're just using the actual like request and response objects and form data objects that are available in the browser. So instead of like bringing in Formic, you're just using form data, because form data has a lot of functionality built into it that you can use. So in using Remix, you're actually learning the web as a platform, which I thought was really interesting. You're not learning someone else's abstraction that they've made. So I thought that was like a plus. And that's actually what pushed me down, like, oh, maybe I should go look at what's available. And I opened up the page and I was like, there's dozens of things here, you know? So it's been, yeah, it kind of pushed me into like, I've been building websites for a while. I know some of these APIs, but I should probably learn more about the platform that I'm working on. Like, and talking with some devs, like I met one of the senior devs at MetaLab today. I'm actually still meeting people like for the first time and chatting with them for the first time, which is wild. But that was something we talked about. Like, you know, things that we wanted to, I wouldn't say improve at MetaLab, but change maybe at MetaLab would be to have less like homegrown abstractions and more kind of like knowledge shared across teams and across projects and stuff. And we ended up talking about like headless UI that Tailwind is building. So headless UI is a bunch of UI components with keyboard support, UI support, or not UI, keyboard support, accessibility support, like doing the thing right minus the styling. And so we were like, that'd be really cool if we could use more stuff like that, because why would I want to rebuild keyboard support every time I want to make something if it, you know, I need to customize how it looks? Or why would I use a UI library that has you know, style is too closely ingrained into what it looks like. Cause that also makes it hard. If MetaLab is a UI focused company, it makes it difficult to, you know, I don't want to fight like unskinning a thing and then reskinning it just to be able to like use a plugin that has good keyboard support. So in my mind, this is kind of similar, right? Like, I guess if you're like to kind of switch it over to like iOS, like iOS has a bunch of controls built in and you probably aren't going to reimplement those native UI controls unless you have a very good reason to.
You really don't want to.
Right. And so that's kind of like, this is pushing me more in that direction. Like, unless I have a really good reason to, why shouldn't I use what's available to me besides, you know, browser support, et cetera. But that's the whole argument that they're making, is like, you should progressively enhance instead of like rewrite wholesale.
Yeah. And the web and modern computers are so fast, you can get away with murder basically by just skipping all that stuff and just blasting stuff to the browser and just let it run. You know, I mean, that's how you get bloat and poor performance in you know, large payloads and lots of downsides and stuff. But a lot of the times that's good enough. But like, you know, to your point, using existing tech to your advantage, you can, that also gets you pretty far. I remember there was a guy who was, I was helping in the Elixir Discord the other day, who was trying to serve up images from his Phoenix application to a CDN. And he was like, oh, I could cache it and do all this stuff. I'm like, dude, just add this. There's a HTTP header you can add. It's called like etag or something. And you just put this header on the response. You serve up your image, you add this header, you pipe it through Cloudflare, you point Cloudflare at it, and it'll cache it and do the right thing. You don't, it's already taken care of. Someone solved this problem already. Why do you have to go and reinvent this wheel and use ets and try to figure out when an image is expired and stuff? No, just put a timestamp on the image, tell it when it's expired, and let the CDN handle it. They're really good at it, I promise. They'll do it better than you can.
Yeah. Like Anthony's just saying, I used to see etag all the time and always wondered what the hell it was. Yeah, same. Hear people talking about it. But, you know,
check it out. Add it to your list. It's a cool little HTTP thing.
Yeah. So Remix actually has, Remix actually has a bunch of videos on YouTube where they talk about like, what is HTTP caching? What is etag stuff? What is, all these different terms that they're talking about. So they do a pretty good job of explaining it, but, yeah, it kind of set me on a little bit of a rabbit hole in kind of researching what was the platform. And so I pulled up the docs. I don't think you can get to the docs without paying for it, but they have a whole document on what they call their philosophy. And the last point they make here is, don't over abstract the underlying technologies. And so it says that the APIs Remix provide make it convenient to use fundamental browser, HTTP, JavaScript, but those technologies aren't hidden from you, which I really kind of like, because they expose the platform to you, right? It's interesting. So we'll see. I'll play around with it more. We'll see if I keep on using it or how it grows, but it's kind of a really refreshing approach. Maybe that's a bad way to use it because I'm not like anti Next, or I'm not anti like these new meta frameworks that are all in on JS. It's just the way that the Remix people talk about their philosophy is compelling to me.
Yeah. When you think about modern web dev, it starts at the high level, but there's always an escape hatch to get down to the low level to do what you need to do. You know, get your hands dirty, make mistakes.
Yeah.
And this is the opposite direction. It says, hey, we'll start with the fundamentals. You can build web apps on them. I promise it'll be fine.
Yeah.
But also, wouldn't it be nice if you could build all this extra stuff in to make it fancy and, you know, modern?
Yeah. So they summarize the Remix philosophy in 4 points. So number one is, embrace the server client model, including separation of source code and content data. So there's paragraphs, but I won't read each paragraph. Number two is, work with, not against, the foundations of the web, browsers, HTTP and HTML. Number three is, use JavaScript to augment the user experience by emulating browser behavior. So that's the on top of the base behavior. And number four is, don't over abstract the underlying technologies. I can get behind those.
It all sounds so nice and idyllic.
Yeah.
In practice, it's still an open question to me of if that is valuable. Do users care? Is my business going to be more successful because I took some ayahuasca and I sat in the desert and thought about HTTP? Like,
right. Well, I think the underlying argument for that is that if you're using, like, you're relying on the fundamentals, you'll get more done faster because you're not having to learn all these new abstractions that are like new to you, right? So like you join a team that's using Formic, you got to learn Formic, but then you switch teams and they're using React Final Form on another project, you got to learn React Final Form. They're all just forms at the end of the day. It's the same means to an end, but the abstractions are different and there's a dozen of them. You know, there's probably multiple dozens of them. So I think the argument for them is that we're not trying to put all these abstractions in here. We're just using what's available and augmenting it to make it nicer if we can. So yeah. So like Anthony is saying, I guess they'd argue you waste time on all the stuff built on top of, which is probably what I just said, but he said it more tersely, which is nice. But no, your point is really great. Like it sounds idyllic. It sounds very, it can maybe sound very ivory tower. Right. And so like one example is they've been touting, you know, HTTP caching a lot. And someone's like, what if you have multiple nodes? How do you do that?
Boom. Roasted.
Right? I was like, I don't know what to do in that case. You got me. I'm off the train, right? But no, it is very idyllic. It's very these like they keep on saying like we want to use the technology that's been around for 15 years, 20 years, right? And that yeah, like that's nice, but also there's probably issues or there's probably a reason why at least some extractions exist on top of them. So.
Or you could just write everything in LiveView and never have to touch JavaScript ever again. That's what we're doing. Works great. Been fine so far.
For now. No, that's great. It sounds cool.
It is pretty awesome. Actually working on a project that has interactive UI and not have to type a single curly brace.
I should say, because the chat's now talking about more Remix stuff, I should say that it's not just the base fundamentals. They give you abstractions, so like they give you APIs where you can do like optimistic UI updates and different things, like more modern techniques, but they just kind of build on top of. So anyway.
Sure.
That sounds really nice. Like I've been keeping an eye on Elixir from afar, and I'm seeing all these things come out. Like Livebook looks really cool. Like all this kind of number crunching, the JIT stuff that came out, the machine learning stuff that they're working on seems really cool. There's so many cool things happening, and I keep looking at it like, oh, that does look nice.
Give it the side eye.
Yeah. It does sound really nice. Maybe it would be maybe fun to like take a couple of weeks and dig into some of that new stuff and compare like when I left Elixir to what it is like now. It could be fun.
I don't know. Yeah, it really hasn't changed that much, I promise. Like Elixir's done. No new features really. But I feel you. There's lots of cool new libraries and stuff, and like we had to do a library, we had to do a thing today involving money. Right? Money's always a pain in the butt to deal with. It's particularly formatting and displaying it.
Yep.
And we're like, oh, man, we got to figure this out and figure out the symbols and the names and the ISO currencies. And does it have zero decimals or two decimals or three decimals? Well, guess what? There's an Elixir package for that. We're getting into the point where it's starting to be like Rails good days where you could just find a gem for anything, right? And Elixir is getting to that point now. We found this beautiful constructed single purpose Elixir library. I don't know. Elixir things don't have a cool name like gems, right? Elixir library package dependency, whatever, that just handles money. And we're literally just going to drop it in and be on our way. Like, how awesome is that? That's what the ecosystem has been missing for a long time. I think we're starting to get to that point.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
That is pretty cool. That's always one of the biggest things that I read when I'm looking around at Elixir, what people like not choosing it. What was it was Grubhub, I think. Like Grubhub rewrote from Django, I believe, to, was it Grubhub or was it DoorDash? It was one of the food delivery apps. They rewrote from a Django app on Python to, I think Python 2, I think they're on an old version of things too. They rewrote it in Kotlin. And one of the big reasons why they went Kotlin was the ecosystem. I think that was like really, really high up on the list of reasons why they would choose a language. And yeah, they ended up picking Kotlin.
I know we talk a lot about the dangers and history, you know, the cruft you can accumulate by building and bringing lots of dependencies. Man, it is just so easy. And if it looks like it's being maintained, you know, only has 8 open issues on GitHub, was last updated within past couple months, has a few hundred stars. Like these are all green signals to me.
Yeah. I've been doing the NPM dance for a little bit here.
Oh God.
So yeah, on the project that I'm on actually today, there was a vulnerability that had come out from one of our dependencies' dependencies. And we have an audit that runs on CI, so we can't merge code in unless the audit passes. And the audit was failing because of a dependency of a dependency. So we had a couple of options. So number one made me feel uncomfortable, but I guess the Yarn has this built in, but with NPM, you have to add a package for this. But you actually can add a package where you can make a config in your package JSON. And it, when you run it, it will actually rewrite the transitive dependency version.
Oh, the version, or it'll actually patch the source?
The version.
Okay.
So it'll like over, because you, the dependency, it's again, the problem is with a dependency of dependency. So you can have this thing go and change that sub to the sub sub dependency, but who knows if that breaks the actual package you're, you know, depending on. Yeah, that made me uncomfortable. I didn't want to do that, so we didn't. The second option was to teach them like the open source stance of like, okay, here's what you do. You go and you
make a fork,
fix it, you PR it,
package JSON at it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Point your package JSON at it. So my client is a security company, and so they see this MR open. They see all of our activity. They see this MR open. And we had in the MR title, we had a vulnerability. And so suddenly a message pops up in the shared company chat. They're like, what's this about? You know, and they had like, so we're like, yeah, it's temporary. We have a couple of reminders to that, to like make sure that the package maintainer doesn't merge this PR. You know, we fix the problem. If they don't merge it, then we'll remove the package or like pull it into our code and maintain it ourselves. So blah, blah, blah. But it was a good learning experience either way. But yeah, the NPM dance, like looking around for similar packages. This one's unmaintained. This one's unmaintained. That one's unmaintained. You know, people always talk about however many hundreds of thousands of NPM packages are, but I wonder how many of them are actually just like AWOL, you know?
The NPM, the package rot is real.
Package rot is right. Yeah. Yeah. Anthony is wagering roughly 99%. Yeah. It's it feels like that some days for sure. For sure. But yeah, that's what I've been up to, I suppose.
Anyway, we're getting on an hour here. I want to wrap it up because I'm fading very quickly.
I can see that.
Yeah. Just kind of like wavering.
Well, thanks everybody for swinging by and chatting with us. If you have any thoughts on Remix, I know everyone has thoughts on the pricing model, so just hit me up and let me know what you think about it. Where can they reach us if they want to complain about, I shouldn't say that, if they have thoughts on the money side of things, where can they reach us?
No, I mean, yeah, Twitter is for complaining.
Yeah.
And we're there. We're not complaining, but we'll hear your complaints. We're on Twitter, DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I'm Sharkwell.
As always, everything we talked about today, all the links, the keyboards, the keyboard layouts, my gists for the carabiner setup, all that stuff is going to be linked in the show notes, and you can find the show notes at dnc.show.
Or you can just watch the show live. We're posting links in the chat on Twitch and Periscope and YouTube, twitch.tv/dncast, Thursday nights, 6 Pacific, 9 Eastern. That's 1 Zulu time for those of you in UTC. That's where we'll be.
Are there any people in UTC?
In England. They're on GMT, which is mostly the same thing. Technically different, but time zones are hard, and I don't want to get into it right now.
I just use libraries to deal with all this stuff. So.
That is the correct
solution. Someone else has dealt with it.
don't try to do it yourself. Trust me.
Yeah,
we've got a guy on our team trying to build a date picker in LiveView for our application, and his feedback at the Sprint Retro today was like, "I hate time zones." That was it.
Yeah, I've been watching For All Mankind, and it's a show about being on the moon and things. And then, yeah, having a colony on the moon and stuff. I'm like, what if we colonize other planets? What then? What then?
Well, the one rotation of the moon is, a day on the moon is about 28 days long, right? Because it's tidally.
What about Mars time?
To Earth. Mars time.
Mars time in there too?
Mars time is a few hours longer than Earth time, right?
Right. But who's going to do the work? I don't think any of the new generation of programmers is going to want to do any of this stuff. So maybe we'll just quit. who among us will volunteer as tribute to do this fundamental extraterrestrial time zone work?
I don't know. Just all switch to Swatch internet time, man.
I vote Thomas. He's the physicist here. He's the smartest of us all. So, Thomas, you've been surrendered as tribute.
You got a one-way ticket to Mars with Elon in the left seat.
Oh, if you want to help Thomas out with planning these time zone changes for other planets, you should join us in the Discord. Thomas is there, and maybe we can make a new channel for this effort, and you can chat with him there. So if you're interested in joining the Discord community, hanging out with us off air, hanging out with a lot of people that are cooler than we are, you should definitely join up on the Discord, and there will be a invite right waiting for you in the show notes. See, Thomas is already talking, and it doesn't make any sense to me. He's talking about velocity and relativity. So whenever I meet Thomas in person, I'm just going to give him a cup of caffeine and just let him go.
Your head might explode.
Yeah.
That's all I got. Happy weekend. Happy marriage. I'll talk to you later.
See ya.